Welcome back to another episode of More from Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hey.
How are you?
Good to see you. Here's me, more of me.
Yeah, there's as a reminder, the goal of this series is to get more from Sam more often. And since we've been getting a lot more of you lately, Sam, we haven't had an episode for a while. Along with subscriber input, I may share my own positions, exaggerated versions of my positions, or play devil's advocate and jump between them seamlessly. And because I'm here in service of Sam, your ideas, I may also abandon any position I authentically hold if I think I can get more from you. Thank you again to all our subscribers for submitting your questions and comments. If you'd like to submit topics for a future episode, you'll need to become a subscriber, and you can do that at samharris.org. And one more announcement quickly. Sam currently has 5 shows on sale: Seattle, San Jose, New York, Boston, and Chicago. I think Boston is sold out. There might be a few remaining tickets in New York, and you can find all the details and ticket links at samharris.org. Okay, on to our first topic. Is it fair to say that what concerns you most about Trump is what's yet to come? What happens to our country after Trump? What happens to our democracy going forward?
No. I'm concerned about what's already happened. I think our democracy has eroded to an impressive degree that a few people right of center seem prepared to acknowledge. I think when you have senators and congresspeople not voting their conscience in the aftermath of January 6th, because they're afraid they might be killed or their families might be killed, something has gone wrong with our democracy, right? That's a very new spot on the map, and it's quite close to tyranny, frankly. So, and that's years ago, right? That's where we're coming from there.
I'm more wondering if you're concerned that it's going to get worse from here, meaning what Trump is doing now and where we are now. Are you not more concerned with what does the future look like?
Well, yeah. If the future gets worse, that's obviously a bad thing, and I'm worried about that. But really, all of my criticism of Trump is based on what has already happened. None of it is hypothetical. I mean, yes, I have on the hypothetical side of the ledger, I have all these things I'm worried about, right? I mean, like, you know, because we don't know what challenges we're going to face as a society going forward, but we know having a greedy, incompetent, self-dealing ignoramus in charge is not optimal. We're putting him in a room with Putin, right, to try to negotiate the end of a war in Europe. He's one of the last people I could think who's qualified to do that. I mean, first, he's showing every sign of being easily manipulated by Putin. And by default, he's anchored to Putin's view of the history of that war, right? He literally spouts old Kremlin talking points in how he describes the war in Ukraine. He sounds like a guy who's really thinking about what a great real estate deal he might do in Moscow when this whole thing is over, right? I mean, if that's what was the only thing going on in his brain, if you could have some South Park episode that showed the condo deal he was really worried about, invading his entire frontal cortex, that would explain it. But he pretends he's strong, but he's the most easily manipulated president we've ever had. And he's anchored, his bias is on the side of, in this case, the dictator who launched a war of aggression into Europe.
Well, speaking of that, Hillary Clinton said she'd nominate Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize if he helped broker an end of the war without capitulating to Putin. Would you?
Well, that final phrase is crucial, right? Without capitulating to Putin.
Of course.
Let's see how that goes.
Right. But if he did, would you support nominating him for Nobel Peace Prize?
I mean, yeah, but who cares? I mean, the Nobel Peace Prize has been so devalued. I mean, Obama got it before he did anything, right? It's a farce. Arafat got it, right? Well, what we know about Arafat's contributions to peace in the Middle East, I mean, there's just nobody should care about the Nobel Peace Prize.
He gets a Peace Prize for refraining from killing anyone.
Yeah.
That was the bar there. You've often mentioned that when Trump is out, we're going to need to rewrite the laws and change everything in order to keep this from happening again, right? You know what I'm talking about, where you'll say, like, on a go-forward basis, let's shore up the norms and make rules that avoid the loopholes from being exploited?
Yeah, I have no hope we're going to actually do that. But yes, I think one of the things we realize is that we have norms that are shoring up our democracy in places where we really should have laws. I mean, because we have the fact that we don't have laws and we only have norms testifies to the assumption that people aren't going to traduce those norms, for corrupt or, otherwise self-serving reasons. But Trump has broken all that kind of invisible structure. So we need real structure that makes it illegal to do certain things. You shouldn't be able to launch a cryptocurrency that is just a mechanism by which you can take bribes from the entire world and enrich yourself to the tune of billions of dollars and use U.S. foreign policy and tariff policy so as to do that better, right? Like there should, there's no, apparently there's, you know, it remains to be seen. I guess maybe one of these court cases is explicitly on that point, but it remains to be seen whether any of that stuff is illegal.
Right. The problem I see with having to rewrite the laws is that anytime you enter into any sort of agreement with somebody, a contract is only as good as the people that are involved. There's a lot of good faith that's required.
Well, no, that's not true. A real contract that's enforceable by law has at the end of it, when you don't live up to your end of it, people with guns showing up at your house and sticking those guns in your face.
Oh, of course. I understand that. I'm saying that generally speaking, when you enter into an agreement with somebody, if you're going to make a deal with somebody, there's a spirit that you're trying to pay attention to. And it's the idea, what I'm getting at is that the history of the success of our country has come from the respect, the relationship between the founding documents and its executors. And now we're being forced to rewrite everything to protect sort of ourselves against an enemy within. And that's sort of not really the point. The point is, if you have to enter an agreement with somebody and you have to...
No, it's become the point. No, and this was something that the founding fathers, I think it's Madison somewhere, anticipated this explicitly. Like, well, you can't have an evil person in the role of the chief executive and expect this system to work, right? I mean, this is, I forget how it was put, but there's some lines to that effect. It should be foreseeable. I mean, we're capable of being so confused and so at odds with one another that the creative and, you know, not boring demagogue can win 51% of the vote. Okay, so now we know that about ourselves, and the rest of the world knows it too.
All right, I'm going to change topics on you.
Yeah.
Unless you have anything else to add there about Trump.
Well, you now need to price in all of the damage that has been done to our reputation. I mean, even if we get rid of Trump and we don't elect the opportunist J.D. Vance in 2028, and we get some sane and ethical president, you know, Republican or Democrat, and we have we try to reset the world's expectations, it's very hard to see how we do that. And we have announced to the world that we potentially stand for nothing other than the whims of the next guy or gal we put in office.
Right. Well, I did like the take that you and Ann Applebaum discussed with J.D. Vance, the idea that he's sort of like tofu, or he sort of takes on the flavor of whatever room he's in at any given time. That was interesting. All right, let's move to Newsom. I know we debated this a few months ago, but I'm going to say it again. Mm-hmm. Gavin Newsom is going to be the Democratic candidate for 2028. Any updated thoughts there?
No. I will wait and see. I mean, I just can't imagine that's a winning ticket. I'm not disputing the guy's talent and charisma in certain contexts, but I just think it's too much baggage to sell to 49 other states.
Right? Yeah, I mean, but what else, what worse could we hear about Newsom at this point?
Well, we can't, but we know that 49 other states and their inhabitants more or less despise him, right? I mean, I haven't seen national polling, but I'd be willing to bet that, forget about him as a person and his Clintonian indiscretions. It's just the bad PR baggage that California as a state has for the rest of the country. I mean, I think a lot of that PR is misinformation at this point, but it's fairly indelible, right? People think California is virtually a failed state. It's like the number four economy on earth at this point. And it subsidizes all the dysfunction of the 49 other states, but the other states think California sucks. Right.
Yeah, I think Gavin makes that case really well, and I think he'll have to stand behind some of it.
That's no match for the Vox Pop interview with the homeless addict in downtown LA or downtown San Francisco who says, yeah, it's so great here. They gave me a lawn chair and all the fentanyl I can take, and it's awesome, right? California, go California. You know.
Yeah, again, I think we're going to need somebody who is as shameless as he is. And he's really a great communicator. He's got a lot of talents. Again, I'm not a fan of his, but I can just see what he's doing. And whoever's working with him behind the scenes and advising him, or if it's him, I just don't see that anyone else is playing that level of Trump politics from the left, you know, that style.
But again, who is he going to convince, right? I mean, it's just, you have to picture people who voted for Trump now voting for Newsom. And that
only 1 or 2%.
Yeah, but
I think he's handsome enough and communicates well, and he'll be able to put out enough good content that he persuades him. Anyway, we don't have to get stuck on this. I'm just, I'm planting my flag.
Talk to me in a year about that. I may have another thought.
I want to come back to your hobby horse for a second and discuss wealth inequality and make two entry points for you. As Scott Galloway has publicly stated a number of times, and I know you share this belief, if you hit your number, 50 million, 100 million, 250, whatever it is, and then you don't start enjoying it by spending it on friends and family and being charitable and helping others, then you're really missing out on the greatest joy of having wealth, right? Mm. And the second part is rich people should be most invested in keeping the pitchforks from the gates. They have won the lottery. So maybe stop building compounds and invest in communities. Thoughts?
Yeah, well, sorry, but to take it from the top down, I mean, the ultra rich people who don't think they have a stake in the common good and who think they can just jet off to New Zealand if things ever get really tough here. I mean, that's one, it's just patently delusional. I was like, I mean, if you're gaming out those end of the world scenarios, you know, you have to think of who's going to protect you and who you're going to, it's just, your pilot on your private plane is not going to leave without his family to go to New Zealand when the world ends, right? So you need to take the pilot's family. And what about your bodyguard's family? And who's going to protect you from your bodyguards when your bodyguards understand that you really have no power now? You're just a guy who bought this compound in New Zealand. It's a ridiculous end game to think that you can privately ensure your survival when the shit really hits the fan, right? So you have as much a stake in civilization not failing as anyone else, as anyone who doesn't have nearly the resources you have.
You should have more of a stake.
I mean, more of a stake, yeah, because life is or should be so good, right? I'm like, you won the game, right? Like, you should be nothing but dessert at this point. So the fact that they don't see that and they're wasting any time, rather than shoring up civil society and improving the government in all kinds of ways that we should improve it, they're engaged in this private effort, like this concierge prepping for the apocalypse. That just seems crazy and just a frank misappropriation of their moral capital, and to say nothing of their actual capital. But yeah, I mean, in addition to that, they should be much more generous in trying to build a functional society wherein other people are happy and secure, right? I mean, they have a stake in other people seeing their dreams realized, right? I mean, do you want to be surrounded by desperate, angry, envious people, or do you want to be surrounded by people who are basically happy and thriving? And the answer is so obvious at any level of wealth. It's so obvious. Now, what's really corrupt here is that we all have a sense, an understandable sense, that our tax dollars are often wasted, right? They're spent on things that we wouldn't approve of if we could kind of line item veto some of these expenditures. We all have this, some version of a Doge idiot in our head. Now, some of that is probably totally unrealistic and irrational, right? I mean, I think one of the lessons of Doge is that there's far less fraud and waste in government than anyone suspected, right? I mean, they went in there just guns blazing looking for fraud, and they found like $15 worth, and then they just started cutting good projects to the bone and alienating, you know, every person who's working for the government. And many of whom are quite talented and could be working in the private sector and are taking a significant, you know, pay cut to serve the country. I'm not saying I don't think there's waste in government, and I'm not saying that I don't think we could spend our tax dollars more wisely, but what we need is a judicious and transparent and nonpartisan and sane look at all that, not some dummy on ketamine with a chainsaw and bad sunglasses. You can't privatize everything. It's the government that's going to fight our wars. It's the government that's going to tell us what the hell to do when the next pandemic happens. It's the government that needs to make sure the food supply and the drug supply is safe, right? And we now have astonishingly ideological and incompetent people in charge of many of these departments. So it's easy to see how trust is going to be difficult to restore at this point. I mean, I don't, like, how much money do I want to send to RFK Jr. at this point to change medical policy in this country? We have to default to a culture of expertise somehow. And I'm not quite sure how we do that in the current environment.
Yeah, I just have to call bullshit on the government employees that out of the goodness of their own heart turned down a private sector job.
It's not everybody, but it's certainly no, some. Right. The idea that we don't have highly competent people working for, they take the State Department. Who goes into this? Who works at the State Department? Who goes to the, you know, the Georgetown program of, you know, Foreign Service and gets a job at the State Department? Some highly competent person, right? Now they could, we might worry that they get, got, you know, certain dogmas in their heads that, you know, that have bent American policy in ways that it shouldn't be bent. I mean, all of that is debatable, but there are people who decide to go into public service because that is what they want to do. That's their vocation. It's not because they looked around and they thought, I have no other opportunities because I'm just mediocre and it's either here or a coal mine, right? I mean, like, that's not the general case. And we want a government that attracts highly competent people. You know, we should pay more. And this Scott Galloway is on this topic, I think, absolutely right. I mean, people in Congress should make a lot of money. The president should make a lot of money. There shouldn't be this incentive to figure out how you can trade stocks or access some revolving door and, you know, become a lobbyist after you were, you know, in Congress or whatever it is. No, these should be good, you know, fantastic jobs, elite jobs, attracting elite people. When we think of the government, we all think of the DMV, right?
Right.
I think even the DMV has probably been overly maligned, right? But everyone has an experience of the DMV that sucks. And it's because, apart from the people there, this is a cartoon to slander the people there, but it's clearly there's a system of incentives there that is not optimal. I mean, if there's no incentive to make your experience great at the DMV, because nothing's going to happen to anyone working there if your experience is terrible, right? So that's an argument that we should privatize everything that can be privatized. Everything that's best done in the private sector should be done in the private sector. Yes, the libertarians are right about that. But there's a tremendous amount that can't be done that way. And there are other things that the market just can't see that are priorities for us. I mean, we just have, you know, tragedies of the commons, and we have, you know, market failures, and we have negative externalities, you know, all of which we need rational people who can, this is even beyond how you run America or any nation state. I mean, we have global problems that the market can't see and that no set of national priorities narrowly focused can prioritize, right? Like, how are we going to forget it? I mean, climate change, like who has the bandwidth to think about climate change right now? I mean, not even Greta Thunberg can think about climate change. She's busy thinking about Gaza. But the only solution to climate change is going to be global, right? The only solution to the problem of nuclear proliferation and ongoing nuclear risk, if only of accidental nuclear war, that's going to be global, right? We're not going to unilaterally disarm. And even if we did, that wouldn't solve the problem, right? So the solution to AI risk as it's emerging is going to be global. We need the deep state to do this stuff, right? What is the deep state? The deep state are people whose jobs aren't necessarily on the line in 3.5 years, right? Who are not political appointees, who don't churn out every 4 years on January 19th with each, you know, new presidency. We need a government that can function across a time horizon that's more than 4 years. And so, yeah, we want a government that attracts some of the most competent and ambitious people in our society.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, because it's now time for, I'm going to stop saying everybody's favorite segment, because it's my favorite segment, the lightning round.
Well, it's a lightning round where my 10-minute answers become 9-minute answers.
So, right, no, where we call on Sam and ask you to keep your answers short-ish, because that's what we're going to get. All right. I'm a retired sex crimes detective, and I really enjoyed your book, Lying. You wrote about the ethics of police going undercover, but I've always been curious about your thoughts on the ethics around criminal defense attorneys. I believe everyone should be entitled to legal defense, but I've always had a hard time with the ethics of telling a jury that a man is innocent of a heinous crime when you know that he is guilty. What do you think of attorneys who argue positions that they don't actually believe, or that they know to be false because it's part of their job mandate?
Yeah, I find this very difficult to rationalize myself. I understand that we need an adversarial system that depends on everyone getting a competent defense, but I personally, I don't know how somebody does that work where they know that if they play their game more successfully than the prosecution, they will set free someone they know to be guilty of some heinous crime. Right? Like I think many defense attorneys will say that they don't know, right? You know, or that, you know, guilt is really just a matter of what gets established in court. I mean, they have some way of pirouetting around the ethics of this. But yeah, I couldn't do that work. I don't see how you defend someone you know is guilty if, again, provided it's a crime that should really trouble everyone, right? You know, you've got somebody who's out there raping and killing little girls, and now you're the defense attorney and you're pretty sure they did it, right? I think you want to lose that case. I mean, ethically, I think you want to lose that case. But that's a very ugly picture, because obviously some people get falsely accused of crimes, and we want those people to have the best possible defense. So I don't know how to square that circle. I think it's a, you know, I couldn't saw the heads off of rats to do medical research either. And yet I would acknowledge that some research still requires that. So it's there's a lot of things I wouldn't do.
You know, a good question. Thank you for submitting that.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think would happen if someone slipped 140 milligrams of MDMA into Donald Trump's Shirley Temple?
I think he would probably have an anxiety attack and not know what had happened to him. Yeah. I think, I don't know. I mean, if it had the right effect, that would be interesting. But, you know, as we know, you know, the effect is transitory, even in the best case, and you need to have some frame around which you put around these experiences so that you can make the new logic reveal they're actionable in your life going forward. I mean, it's not a matter of the state change becoming permanent. It's a matter of what the state change implies about all your other moments when you're contracted and distracted and prioritizing other things, right? So the short answer is, even if it had the desired effect and he was as happy and as compassionate and as loving and as ethical as many people can be for, you know, those 3 or 4 hours, barring some real effort at integration, I wouldn't think anything about him would change.
I guess the follow-up here would, do you think if that did happen, you think he would ask for a bump or he would just move on?
No, honestly, for anyone, if you don't know why this change in you is happening, I mean, if somebody is dosed without their knowledge, I got to think it often produces a major anxiety reaction. You know.
Okay, next question. What does Sam think are the most important careers and paths of study for the next generation? And what advice related to this are you giving your daughters as they go out into the world?
Well, that's a very good question. It's obviously on a lot of people's minds at the moment. Ironically, I think AI in success, in the limit, you know, short of destroying us, but in the limit of its actual useful application and, you know, all the job canceling effects implied there. Ironically, the value of the humanities kind of comes rocketing back to us, right? It's like, well, what kind of expertise stands a chance of still being valued in that environment? I think the jobs that will be by definition the most secure are the jobs where we care that there's a person, a real person on the other side of it. I think we're going to want people who are even if they use these tools, we're going to want creative, insightful people who can, at a minimum, be the curators of the best that AI can produce, right? You're going to want, if there's any human layer that we're going to want, it's going to be on the side of art and philosophy and literature, and it's the humanities, right? And this is that side of the quad. No one's going to care who coded the software that flies the robot jet, right? I mean, we just want it to work. The moment AI takes over coding, coding's gone. That's not the same with poetry, or need not be the same with poetry, or film, or novels, or, I mean, so I do think that studying, I mean, honestly, I loved studying philosophy. I think, I mean, it's often a maligned degree. I think it was actually a fantastic degree even at the time. I think it's probably only going to be a better degree going forward. We're going to want clarity of thought and creativity from people insofar as we want people at all to be doing any of these jobs.
Yeah, I thought you'd say something like that and even just look regardless of the career choices.
That's because I'm just an LLM at this point and I'm just completing the sentences the way you expect.
No, I figured you'd say something like, look, the way it's impossible to predict the future, but it's good to be a critical thinker. It's good to be a kind person. It's good to be the kind of person people want to be around. I know that doesn't exactly answer the career, but whatever you're doing.
But the creativity point answers the career. I mean, we're going to want to deal with some human products, right? Until we don't. I mean, if in fact we, I mean, this could just be the last stand of sentimentality, right? I mean, it really could be an illusion, but it still seems compelling to me. I really have no interest in reading an AI-generated novel insofar as I care about other people out there in the world, in history, in the present. I want to know what they thought. It's like, if you could give me an AI-generated version of James Joyce's next novel, I don't care about it. Now, maybe the next generation is going to care about that just as much as they're going to care about James Joyce's real novels. But yeah, this could be like an okay boomer moment. I have no idea. But my intuition is that the beauty that human beings are capable of producing, we're still going to want. Move it over to sports, right? I mean, do we really want to see robots play basketball? Is the NBA in jeopardy because there's going to be a robot league where they're better basketball players? I don't think so. I mean, maybe I would watch one robot basketball game, but the idea that we're just going to want to see better and better robots dunk more and more, and just everything's a dunk from midcourt, right? Like,
I think sports are still going to stand the test of time, or at least for the foreseeable future, because exactly that. You want to see somebody represent you. You want to see the greatest in the human.
And you want to see the failure too. Like, right. Like, there's no robot failure doesn't mean anything.
Right. That's right. Right. Okay. When was the last time you changed your mind on something you had a fairly strongly belief in?
It's actually just in this area of AI and automation. I mean, I've said this before, but I mean, this is a pretty big change. I think I signed some open letter at one point saying that, above all, we don't want AI autonomous weapons, right? Like, this is a no-go area for the tech. This is probably, if anything is stupid, building killer robots is stupid, and it probably is stupid, but would be even more stupid to let the Chinese build killer robots and then be on the receiving end of their tech, right? So we're clearly in an arms race. If we can't get out of this arms race, we want to win this arms race. So I think we want the best technology we can build on that front. And this is a global problem that needs to be solved globally. And I do think it's a disaster that we are in an arms race of this sort. And I'm quite worried about the implications of AI in all of our tech, but in the defense industry, perhaps particularly. And yet China's not going to stop. So
we have a forced choice between bad and worse there.
And nearer term bad versus long term bad. Imagine, I think if we win an arms race, again, short of AI getting away from us, which I'll be talking about on the podcast soon, we'll be in a position to dictate the global terms for how we de-escalate, and non-proliferate, et cetera.
Right. That would be great. It'd be great to get what's his name? Palmer Luckey. Have you seen that guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So I mean, that 5 years ago I would have totally recoiled from his whole project, but I'm now quite happy he's doing it. So I've changed my mind about that.
What happened to your appearance on the All In podcast? Well, I guess I can answer that.
I never got that invitation.
All right.
I wonder why.
Yeah. I saw Jason post something about. No, he sent it to us.
Yeah, you sent that to me. He posted on X, I think, that he was. I mean, as though we already had a scheduled date. Like he said, I'm going to have Ezra Klein on the podcast. I'm going to have Sam Harris on the podcast. This is like coming up on the podcast. I think they did have Ezra Klein. I mean, I know why. First of all, I wasn't waiting for an invitation to go on the podcast. So it's I'm not annoyed that I haven't gotten one. It was just sort of odd that they said I was coming on and then there's been no communication. But the reason why is obvious, right? I mean, it's like they can't say anything too negative about our former mutual friend Elon Musk, because they're not willing to give any critical perspective on him as a person. I mean, there's just too much sunk cost there. I mean, there's a misperceived sense of loyalty there, I think, at least on Jason's part. I mean, the other guys, I think, just agree that Elon is a genius and super ethical and leading the world in all the right directions. And so that I don't think they want me to sound off on that at all.
I thought Jason might want you on as some support for some of his positions, given that you guys probably share most positions.
Well, he might. I haven't spoken to him in a long time. I think Jason is a great guy. He's an incredibly loyal friend, and I think to a fault, he's a loyal friend. And I think that's where his master ethic is loyalty, and in this case, he's being loyal to two friends by not having a conversation about one of them.
Right. Right. Well, it's a great podcast. So maybe they'll invite you on. It'd be fun to hear you go into the Lion's Den over there. All right. Next question. I've been impressed with your use of the English language and your vocabulary since I first heard you speak many years ago. How did you develop those skills?
Well, you actually can develop them in the sense that you can consciously grow your vocabulary, right? I mean, like that is something that I did at one point as a teenager. It's like, at a certain point, you recognize that the difference between knowing what words mean and not is enormous. I mean, you don't know what people are talking about. If they're using words that you don't own, I mean, obviously there are gradations of this, right? There's knowing what a word means in context, but not knowing it so well that you would ever think to use it yourself, right? You couldn't command it yourself, but when someone drops it, you get the gist, or you even might know exactly what it means, but that word is never going to come to your lips on its own. I think you want to own more words because you want to be able to think clearer thoughts, right? But there's a ceiling effect here because you also want to be intelligible to other people, right? You don't want to just alienate an audience by using words, consciously using words that you know 99% of them won't know. And you don't want to be endlessly pedantic in defining the word, the good word you just used, when you could have used another word. And so it's a hard balance to strike. I mean, my friend Christopher Hitchens, obviously verbally quite smart and had an enormous vocabulary and would wield that vocabulary in front of any audience to his own satisfaction in ways that I thought were sometimes at the expense of effective communication, right? I mean, he was doing, you know, verbal backflips, but losing a lot of his audience. And so I earlier in my career, I was more guilty of that than I am now. Like now I'm trying to be simpler in how I communicate, because if the purpose really is to communicate and not lose people, well, then you don't want to be just erudite for the point of being erudite, right? You don't want to just use big words when little words will suffice. But you can consciously grow your vocabulary by simply being diligent and looking up words that you don't know whenever you encounter them. And by don't know, I mean don't truly own. Like when you recognize, you see a good word in context when you're reading or you hear someone say it, and you recognize that's not a word you would ever use, look it up and learn to use it, right?
But I think it's less about your vocabulary and your command. It's more about the artful way that you use words, I think.
Mm.
You're very creative in your word choice, your word usage. And I'm wondering, where is that just a combination of some sort of artistry that,
well, you know, I think
it's almost like you speak in prose?
Well, insofar as that's true, I think it's probably bleed through of my writing mind into my speech. To some degree, I'm always writing, at least a little bit, when I'm speaking. I'm thinking about the way words appear on a page. Not explicitly, but I have a writer's mind. I mean, because I think of myself at least some of the time as a writer and have spent a lot of time writing, I'm trying to write when I speak. I mean, I'm trying to speak as I, not exactly as I write, but insofar as that's possible, more like I write than otherwise would be normal for a person, certainly a person who never thinks about writing.
I think that makes sense. It sounds like you're creating or crafting something that you might put down on a page, but when you're communicating.
But I fail shockingly. When you look at a transcript of virtually anything I say, it is not prose, right? I mean, it's fairly Trumpian word salad. I mean, I give Trump a lot of shit for how badly he speaks, and he does speak impressively badly most of the time, but virtually everyone when transcribed is just a jumble of phrases that trail off into ungrammatical awfulness. And so, I mean, this is a point that Janet Malcolm made in her book, The Journalist and the Murderer, I think that's the title. That you just, you know, anyone who transcribes, any nonfiction journalist who in an article transcribes their subject's speech exactly, leaving every and I mean and glitch intact, I mean, that's just pure vandalism on a person's reputation. I mean, it's just that's not how you should do it. I mean, there's a generation of journalists who haven't figured out that you actually have to rewrite people faithfully in order to make them seem remotely intelligent on the page, because virtually no one speaks in perfectly formed sentences.
Okay, next question. Thanks. Yeah. You've talked about being totally dense to music like Bach, but what music do you really like?
Oh, I like a lot of music, but I actually, contrary to the expectations of many people who think I'm an Islamophobe, I love Islamic music. I mean, I love North African music. I love Qawwali music, you know, Pakistani, mystical Sufi music. That's probably half of what I live. If I just boot up my favorite playlist, probably half of it is in Arabic or Urdu, right? So that's, who knows what they're saying. I mean, they could be saying, let's kill the Jews, but I don't care. I love the music.
It's got a good melody to it.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. Curious about your thoughts and or your personal relationship with substances like alcohol, cannabis, and nicotine. And anything else you want to add in there?
No nicotine, very little cannabis. I mean, occasionally I'll, these days, take an edible, but I don't love the result often. So yeah, it's pretty infrequent that I do anything with THC. I'm basically a one drink a night person on average every night for, you know, years and years, you know, I mean, now decades. Sometimes it's two, sometimes it's none. I mean, for a long time, it was probably two drinks a night on average. I think I've cut my intake by half in the last year or so, just because I find that I actually don't metabolize it as well as I used to. I mean, I can actually get a hangover from two drinks. And I mean, that was never true. And I always feel like a moron waking up with a headache as a result of having had too much alcohol. So yeah, I mean, one or none is kind of the default now, and two at most is kind of the new ceiling for a 24-hour period. I mean, I find if I'm on vacation or whatever and I drink three drinks, I mean, honestly, I can have a headache that lasts for 2 days after that. So it's no fun. So I have still stumbled into that, but every time I get the lesson lands a little deeper that I don't want to be that guy next time. So.
But there's no chance you're joining that alcohol-free movement.
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't be joining it for a perceived dysfunction in my life born of alcohol, right? Like, I don't feel like I have a drinking problem, but I do feel like increasingly I don't metabolize it as well. So, like, it just seems stupider to drink myself into a place of, you know, very likely having a headache the next day, right? So it's and if that ever becomes one drink, you know, is guaranteed or, you know, virtually guaranteed to make me feel terrible the next day, well, then I would stop drinking. But it would just be because, all right, now you're the guy who can't metabolize alcohol.
Well, I think we got to get you over to some good tequila because that's the best recipe. Yeah. I think so. I can sometimes taste the poison now more and more as I get older, but there's just no way I'm stopping having drinks. It's just the other impacts are too great for me. The social impacts, the ability just to be around people and enjoy them. I can't give that up.
No, I mean, it's a hard thing to extol because there's the other side of it. I mean, there's so many people whose lives are destroyed by alcohol and we sound insane to say that there's a good side to it, but there is a good side to it if you actually don't have a drinking problem, right? If you can drink one drink or two drinks and you're fine and you just have fun and it's just a social lubricant and you enjoy the event better as a result and you haven't embarrassed yourself and you haven't said the thing you wish you hadn't said and you didn't fuck up your relationship and you didn't, you know, have a car accident. And I mean, if none of that is on the menu and it just improves your experience and there is no intolerable physiological downside the next day, well, then why not? But I mean, you know, increased cancer risk and all of that aside, I mean, I think so. You know, there was a moment there where we thought one or two drinks a night was actually the top of the U-shaped curve where, you know, you were optimizing your health. I don't think we think that anymore. I think we more or less think any alcohol is a net negative, but it's not so many. Insofar as I've looked at those data, it's not, you know, the risk of drinking one drink a night or two drinks a night didn't seem to me to be, you know, life-wrecking risk of cancer the way that, you know, smoking a pack of cigarettes a day would be.
Yeah, it's something like you lose 2 weeks on your life for having one to two drinks right. a night. I'll make that trade.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, obviously that's not the way, that's in the aggregate. That's not the way it shows up for the person who suddenly is told they have mouth cancer or whatever the likely cancer is. But yeah, I mean, obviously it's a risk trade I've been willing to make up until now. But yeah, I am drinking less now, however, than I was a year ago.
All right. We're going to have to end it there. Thanks again to everyone who submitted topics and comments. If you'd like to, unless you have anything else you want to add, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No.
Let me
stay in school. Don't drink. All
right. If you'd like to help with this show in the future, you can head over to Sam's page on Substack and submit questions and participate in the online community. That's it for this episode. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
See you soon.